On this week's Dose, we have Larson Jensen, former Olympic swimmer, Navy SEAL, and current founder and general partner at Harpoon Ventures.
Larson has always surrounded himself with some of the highest performers and most successful people, whether in the water next to the likes of Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte, or out in the battlefield serving our country.
It was only after a friend mentioned VC as a potentially exciting career path that Larson realized he could leverage his experiences, specifically regarding the government's growing partnership with the private sector in investing in new technology.
Yeah, in the interview, you'll hear more about how he started Harpoon Ventures, some notable portfolio companies, as well as his outlook on the next few years in venture capital.
And we close out this week's Dose with a short discussion on the future of AI, some awesome advice to the pilgrims, and some great perspective from Larson reflecting on his experience getting an MBA at Stanford.
It was a pleasure and an honor hosting Larson on this week's Dose, and we're excited to share our conversation with you all. So here's our interview with Larson.
This is Venture Pill, your weekly dose of startups and venture capital. We break down recent startups in the news and interview founders and investors to help you stay informed in the evolving world of venture. On this week's Dose, we have Larson Jensen, former Olympic swimmer in the 2004 and 08 Olympic Games, Navy SEAL, and current founder and general partner at Harpoon VC. Larson, thanks for joining us today. How's it going?
Thanks for having me, guys. It's awesome to be here.
It's truly our pleasure. And let's get into it. We'd love to hear a little bit more about your life before venture capital to start off. Not many can say that they've been an Olympic swimmer and a Navy SEAL, much less a venture capitalist. And so with that, we'd love to hear about your journey to venture capital and how those prior experiences ultimately led you into the business world and attending Stanford GSB.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. In large part, it's, I would say, accidental. It's funny how life works out that way, that you know, you have plans, but curveballs come your way and things you never really thought you'd be doing, you end up doing. I think that was the case with my swimming career. In my early adolescence, I grew up on an almond farm and had the fortunate opportunity to swim in the summertime where it was abysmally hot. I grew up in Bakersfield, California, which I sort of dubbed the Texas of California, nice. Which is, you know, lots of country music and oil drilling out there. But in the summertime, as I mentioned, it gets pretty hot. So my folks threw me into the water at a young age, and I had the opportunity to develop that into a talent in the swimming pool, which I'm happy to share more about as well. I had the opportunity to swim in 04 and 08 to represent my country on the playing field, or which in my case was the swimming pool. And then I felt this debt of gratitude of giving back and trying to test myself again at the next level, which drew me to the United States military and more specifically the SEAL community in the United States Navy, which I was tested to the next level, both in terms of going through BUDS and then deploying overseas with some amazing colleagues and friends of mine. But while I was in the SEAL teams, I had the opportunity to work with the best technology that our government has to offer, at least from a special operations standpoint. And on one hand, I was blown away by the emerging technology like Palantir that we had the opportunity to work with. And on the other hand, I was pretty frustrated with some of the incumbent legacy technology that we had that was oftentimes decades old. And I found myself at this intersection wondering why that's the case. Why do I, in my pocket, I forget what it was, had the iPhone 3, 5, whatever it was at the time. I'm like, why is this so powerful in some of the day-to-day technology that we use in the SEAL teams, not, you know, keeping pace? So out of that curiosity, I was really drawn to Silicon Valley. And I had some friends of mine from my undergraduate years who were serial entrepreneurs. They'd sold their first business already, were starting a new one. And they, you know, put the idea in my head. They said, Larson, there's not too many people with your background in Silicon Valley. I think you could come up here and do a great job. You're a different pedigree than most folks in Silicon Valley. So I took that as the impetus, the clue that I could think about something that was next. And, you know, fast forward a little bit, I had the opportunity to have my first job in Silicon Valley was at Andreessen Horowitz, where that was, you know, talk about drinking through a fire hose. That was a huge fire hose moment for me. Not only learning how they think about investing in deals, how they think about, you know, nurturing the portfolio, but how they thought about redefining the venture model. At the time, there really wasn't a services-based venture capital firm, with the exception of Andreessen Horowitz. And they went out there and I think reshuffled the deck in venture capital to make everybody else, you know, play on their turf. And so that was a huge formative experience for me. But thereafter, I had the opportunity to go to Stanford to get my MBA and subsequently go over to Lightspeed. And it wasn't until I was at Lightspeed that our current focus came into perspective and we decided to launch Harpoon Ventures.
Awesome. Yeah. So you got kind of that introduction in the cutting edge at A16Z and then at Lightspeed. Like, any particular industries? We'll get into a little bit more about Harpoon, but what got you most excited there in terms of the portfolio companies and or the companies that you were diligencing during that time? Any particular ones come to mind or industries?
Sure. While I was at Lightspeed, I was primarily on the enterprise team. So enterprise infrastructure, cybersecurity, and there was also some degree of deep tech. There was some drone tech, et cetera, that we had invested in at the time there. And so I think it was actually a decent representation of the types of things that we're investing in now at Harpoon. One of the critical insights that I gleaned while there, intersecting with my background, was that there was going this new modern era of technology was going to have further reaching geopolitical and national security implications than I think people really realized at the time. Back then, that was in the 2015 to 2017 timeframe. And a lot of my colleagues who were still in uniform at the time were telling me, hey, you know, China's becoming a big deal. We need to be prepared for this. They're investing heavily in machine learning and other enabling technologies and deep technology space, et cetera. And frankly, we had our orientation towards a different conflict area in the Middle East during that time frame where I served, and really didn't have our eye on the ball in terms of large near peer competitors geopolitically. So we became, as a country, rather flat footed in terms of embracing emerging technology because we owned, from a conflict standpoint, the technology in the Middle East. We had air superiority, we had night vision, we have all these things that really our adversaries at the time, you know, we were far further tech enabled. But as we think towards the future, not just from a national security standpoint, but from an economic security standpoint, I think we became a little bit flat footed as a country in terms of really prioritizing those investment areas. And so it's really when I was there that I thought this new area of technology was going to be extremely important for a lot of reasons. It hasn't been until very recently that I think that's become a consensus driven opinion. At the time, it was non-consensus. And those are the areas that we invest in. We want to invest in the next generation of enterprise technology, the modern data stack, cybersecurity, AI, deep technology, which can include autonomy, space, et cetera. And those are the areas that we've really prioritized as a firm because we think those technology areas are going to be very important, critically important to the future of the United States.
And so was there a particular moment where the switch flipped and you, you know, knew that you had something to build with Harpoon VC?
There definitively was. Or I shouldn't say it's like an instant or a moment or a day, but it was a period of weeks and into months. What I saw while I was at Lightspeed was the emergence of a lot more government innovation front doors, organizations like the Defense Innovation Unit, organizations like AFWERX and others that were standing up around the country beyond the research labs to provide a conduit for commercially focused businesses to support government problem sets. So that concept is called dual use technology, at least inside of the government, is how people advertise it. In Silicon Valley, I still think most people don't really know what that means, but as the way the government describes it, it's companies that are built for the commercial sector, they're built for the modern enterprise, and then an expansion market, a follow-on market opportunity is the government sector, all predicated on the thesis that I currently believe in, that the majority of the best talent in the world in these new technology areas is going into Silicon Valley venture-backed companies. If you look at the AI talent, the cybersecurity talent, the deep tech talent, they're really going to these next generation startups, some of which are of significant scale at this point. I mean, I don't really know if SpaceX can be considered a startup any longer, but the best rocket scientists in the world are going to SpaceX and other private sector companies. So if that's the case, how do we make sure that the government doesn't get laggard technology, that they get the true bleeding edge, the best things? I think it's a safe bet to say that if we want to help them get the best technologies available, that we need to follow the talent. And I think the talent is truly going to these venture-backed startups. And so for us, what I observed at that point in time was that this is the case. And that if we want to really do well by doing good, if you will, or vice versa, we should invest in these companies and show them the clear path to government market opportunities to help them expand their businesses and also support our country at the same time.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just fascinating when you look at the history of venture capital kind of coinciding with the government's investment in new technology and that shift of the talent. I hadn't really heard it put that way. But we've certainly been very interested in a lot of the technology that we've been seeing in that sector. We have a close friend of mine that I grew up with, Tom Smith. He's in the Air Force. He's working over at HBC down the road for a year,
kind of
helping
them
out. Yeah, yeah. So we love keeping a pulse on that. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the last several years with Harpoon. Any notable portfolio companies that really get you excited? We'd love to hear about that.
Now, there's a lot of them that really get us excited. And I think, laying a little bit more of the groundwork for that and, jumping on some of the things that you're talking about, government intersection with Silicon Valley is how Silicon Valley started. There's plenty of books out there about it. Power Law is a great one. Steve Blank has been putting out a lot of really interesting information on this collaboration. And it used to be back during the space race and, a little bit thereafter, if you wanted to solve a really hard, audacious problem, you really had to go to a government-funded program if you wanted to build the internet or build GPS or build rockets. There wasn't a private capital ecosystem that was evolved enough or sophisticated enough or large enough to support that type of a risk-taking at an early stage to capitalize those types of businesses. So back then, what you really did see is the best talent in the world going to support those problems. Move forward into the software revolution, into the internet boom in the 2000s, the venture capital ecosystem became much more sophisticated. People started to build on top of the internet. And I think we lost sight as a country and as an ecosystem in Silicon Valley of building these really audacious products for really audacious use cases. I think it's very recently that we've actually started to have a resurgence of that, where, back to the prior point, we have talent that can now be very well capitalized to the tune of what used to be a government program. Now you can, it's odd and it's different and it's rare, but you can raise $100 million Series A and a multi-$100 million Series B if you're going after something that's truly audacious enough. That is totally possible. Previously, where else would you get that money? A program from Uncle Sam. And so what I think is a really unique combination is trying to find opportunities where you can get those programs from Uncle Sam, pair them with venture capital, and actually really, bring something special to market. And I think there's going to be more opportunities like that that exist. In terms of our own portfolio, the opportunities that we've seen exist like that thus far are both on the deep tech side of the house, the software side of the house, et cetera. So some notables that are standouts for us is Astranis, which is a next generation satellite communication satellite. They provide internet broadband from geostationary orbit. They're doing great things. Soligen, which is another Texas company. They're down the road in Houston, so I guess closer to you than me. Merlin Labs is an autonomy company that's helping, transition existing fleets of aircraft to operate autonomously. And I don't want to, lead the witness and help people presume that we're all deep tech or frontier tech, because we've got a pretty deep cybersecurity book as well, to include material security, SEMGREP. We have AI for drug discovery in the form of Genesis Therapeutics, AI security with robust intelligence, and a variety of other companies that we're extremely excited about. Some recent ones that are unannounced, one in the protein sequencing space that we're excited about, a repeat founder in the security ETL space, and just a lot of really exciting people building very large and audacious visions in a variety of sectors.
Yeah, those, we're going to have to check those out. Yeah. Those are some awesome sounding startups.
Just rattle them off.
Definitely a diversified, robust portfolio that y'all have been building at Harpoon. Curious if there's any common traits or qualities that you look for in a founding team.
There absolutely is. I think it really does come down to the team. In my formative years of my venture education and what I learned at business school and by being mentored by a lot of these luminaries of industry, it really does come down to team, market and product. But I've evolved into thinking that you can solve for everything by virtue of the team. If the team is truly world-class and they have deep domain expertise in what they're building, you can generally solve for whether or not they're capable of building the product or not. If they understand what needs to be built and for whom, who's the desperate customer. Those are really important things to assess, but I do think it goes down to the team. Also, you can think about the market opportunity. If a founder is building a widget with nobody who's going to buy it, that company is unlikely to succeed. So we think it's really important for this team to understand how they're going to bring this new product to market. If it's truly novel, is it 10x better on a price performance basis? Meaning, is it 10x faster or 10x cheaper? And if it's not, you're really going to have a hard time getting large scale adoption because nobody wants to buy from a startup unless you're desperate. Nobody ever gets fired for buying from IBM is the old analogy, right? So how are you going to overcome that bureaucratic or incumbent inertia? You need to have a price performance advantage and hopefully a edge in terms of how you're going to deliver that product and to whom and who's desperate for it. So for us, it does come down to the team. We've backed both situations. We backed first-time founders. We backed multiple-time serial founders, and we backed people who've started a business before that subsequently hasn't worked out very well. We've repeat-backed founders of ours that it didn't work out well last time, and now we think it will because we think they've learned the hard lessons. I think for us, and our preference is to work with people that have been in an industry that they're now building for, that are repeat founders, that know how to hire, that know how to fire, that know how to ship product, that know how to raise money, know how to sell product, know how to really understand when the customer's eyes light up and when they don't, and when they need to pivot. Because building these startups is abysmally hard. What's Elon say? Building a startup is like, chewing glass and staring into the abyss. That's the way it is, for sure. That's the way it is. These founders oftentimes are handling so much pressure that it really is a Herculean feat. And I admire all of them for what they're doing because I don't think anybody sane starts a startup, myself included. I don't think if I was sane, I wouldn't have started my own venture firm. But at the same time, I think some people are so compelled by a gap in the market and a vision they have to foster in a brighter future that they feel like they have to. That's how I felt about starting Harpoon, and that's how I think our founders think about starting their businesses.
Yeah, that's certainly admirable and gets to a question we wanted to ask. As you look back to the early days of deciding to ultimately launch Harpoon and now the last several years of building it, what were some of the unexpected challenges? Like maybe how would you have done it differently? Would you have done it again? Give us a feel.
I would have 100% done it again. And I think there's things that we did by accident that worked out well. And there's things that we did on purpose that did not work out well. So I think it's a little bit frustrating in that regard. But as we launched our first fund in the 2018 and closed in 19 timeframe, how we did it by accident was essentially raising a minimal viable pool of capital, deploying some percentage of that capital into our first few deals that we could point to and say, hey, Mr. and Mrs. LPs out there, investors and venture funds, this is a representative slice of what we're going to be doing. These are the types of companies that we're going to be investing in. And we did that sort of sequentially throughout the year. And so we'd raise some money, invest some money, raise some money, invest some money. And before we knew it, we had a fully built out portfolio and had a fund size of about $55 million. And so it was a lot of hard work. But at the same time, totally worth it. And how I'd recommend, frankly, anybody starting a venture fund to do it. We didn't have that playbook in the back of our mind. We just sort of made it up, but it worked out. And I was very fortunate that we're able to do it that way. Fast forward into 2021, which everybody knows was a hot financing market. LP appetite for venture capital was virtually off the charts. IPOs were off the charts. LPs were getting a lot of distributions that year and into 22 as well. And so they were really anxious and excited about redeploying into the asset class that had performed so well for them over the past decade. So we were beneficiaries of that as well. We raised our second fund, which was about $120 million in size in 2021. So you can sense a pattern here that we've generally had 2-year investment cycles, 2 to 3 year investment cycles from 2019 to 2021. And then we went out and market again in 2023. And what we saw was a market that was the polar opposite of what we saw in 2021. There's no realizations, no distributions. LPs that were previously clamoring to invest in venture capital were retracting and wanting to put their money in more more cash yielding assets like fixed income, and you could invest in treasuries and still nearly meet your rate of return expectations if you're an endowment. So it was much, much harder. But we still were able to raise a larger fund size than we did in 21. I think purely because we had a captive audience of LPs that we'd worked with, that we'd built trust with, that we, you know, got to show them that we were good stewards of their capital, and they were inclined to re-up and work with us again. But that said, we still had to be patient with their timing in terms of when they were ready to allocate and when they weren't. And so it's definitely become much more of an LP market, an investor's market. I think that ultimately, now here we are in, you know, end of 23 into 24 now, it's definitively an investor's market. If 21 was an entrepreneur's market, now I think it's an investor's market. And that trickles all the way upstream to the LPs. That's an investor's market for them. They can truly pick and decide who they're going to cut and who they're going to add, terms that they can push. Same thing with GPs all the way down to the founders. It's an investor's market. I think we have favorable pricing on our side with talent and entrepreneurs who are still building hugely ambitious things in the world of AI and deep tech and defense tech, et cetera. So I think it's a great time for investors to be investing in venture capital funds. I sort of not so jokingly tell LPs that I talk to that I think regardless of who you back in this vintage, you're going to have a great performing vintage. And almost regardless of who you backed in 2021, you're probably not going to have a great performing vintage. Yeah. So it's interesting how that time diversification plays out, because there's some aspects of this that are uncontrollable, which is the market dynamic.
Yeah, from 2019 to 21 to now, feels like y'all have gone through a full mini market cycle.
Oh yeah, and we're leaving out the whole COVID debacle. Yeah. I mean, that was a whole other area. Who would have thought? I mean, when you think about this has been a hugely truncated learning cycle as a manager of a venture fund. We raised our first fund, and all of a sudden we're hit with COVID and lockdowns. Nobody thought work from home was going to work. Who would have? Nobody bet on that. Nobody bet on this massive rally that occurred while everybody was working from their garages and basements. Nobody thought that was going to happen. And I think we were fortunate that we had this great investor base in LPAC that was saying, hey, these are generally the best times to be investing in startups, to be investing in asset classes. When people are scared, you want to be a little bit more greedy within reason. And when people are greedy, you want to be a little bit more scared. And so that was a huge learning point for us to live through and work through. And I don't think it would have been the same learning had I been doing this somewhere else, because I had to internalize the pressure of, you know, trying to deploy friends, family, institutions, first responders, their capital, and doing so within the best interest of my fiduciary. A very challenging situation to go through, but fortunately we navigated through it. And then again, in 2023, who would have thought we would have had a regional banking crisis where we were nervous that we were going to have many of our companies lose all of their deposits. And there was this weekend that was pretty contentious and pretty scary. But going through that again, I think leads to some, you know, more fortitude as a manager, which I think is extremely important. I like to say, you don't know who you are as an individual until you've been tested. You don't know who your teammates are until you've been tested with them. And I think that you can't always choose when you're going to be tested, but you can be prepared for it. I think fortunately, I've been tested in various career fields, whether it be the swimming pool, the battlefield, or now in the world of finance, that I think I know who we are and how we're going to handle really difficult situations. And that makes me pretty excited about the future. Doesn't mean we're going to get everything right, but I think we're going to handle it right.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. I think it was almost a year ago with the SVB Bank. Like, I think it was last March.
Yeah, it was.
Pretty crazy how that shook out. And I think I heard you paraphrasing Warren Buffett there with the being greedy when others are fearful.
Yeah.
Fearful when others are greedy. And so on that note, you've done a great job of summarizing how the past five, six years have gone. What's your outlook for the next 3, 4, 5 years looking forward?
I'm extremely optimistic about the world of technology and how it's going to transform the world that we live in. It seems like by the day, I have a new AI plugin that's helping my job get slightly more effective, slightly easier, et cetera. I wouldn't say it's easier necessarily, but I could be more productive with the time that I have. So I think that's really exciting. The knowledge worker improvement that we're going to have through generative AI is really earth shattering. But that said, the cost of starting a business continues to plummet. We're going to enable ourselves to be more productive. I think that we're entering an era of abundance, which is really exciting. And it's fascinating to see, like, at every predecessor generation of technology, everyone assumes that Moore's Law is dead or that we can't evolve any further. And the future couldn't be further from the truth. Who would have thought a handful of years ago that we'd have multiple multi-trillion dollar businesses? Nobody, right? Like, at least not me. But I think it's these non-obvious, obvious things that really excite me. And I think that we are going to be entering an age of abundance over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think that investing in the earliest stages of venture capital provides, you know, us and our investors the best opportunity in the world to see that upside.
Definitely. Yeah, it's an exciting time to be in the space. And certainly a big goal of our show is helping the pilgrims. That's what we call our listeners, the loyal listeners to VenturePil, helping them just learn about what's going on, get involved with regard to specifically AI, like you're saying, a world of abundance. Yeah. You know, there are many that say AI is going to replace my job and people are scared. What do you say to those people? How should people take advantage of it in their day-to-day or in investing or both?
It might not be really resolving any of those concerns to say, but that's how every era of technology has always evolved. Like, everyone's been concerned that their job was going to be replaced. And ultimately, that's not necessarily what happens. People get to spend more time on the things that are higher order of productivity. And that's how I view it with my job. I think that's how a lot of our founders view it with their jobs. For the code that they're writing, now they have code AI co-pilots that help these engineers become more productive. What's another one of the stats I saw recently that's really remarkable is that in the next 10 years, the number of software developers on this planet is going to over double. Now, what happens when you have double the software developers and now you give them superpowers by generating code autonomously using AI, using best practices? I think that's a great thing for our world and for humanity, that we're going to be able to create more software-enabled products and services, which can oftentimes intersect with hardware to help us create greater output and greater abundance for our economy and for our globe. I think that that's the trend of where things are going. So I'm personally very optimistic about it. You start looking in the world of robotics and computer vision and autonomous systems. There's a whole lot of very dangerous jobs out there that I think we can now move towards autonomous types of solutions to help save lives, to include on the battlefield where I previously served and I have many buddies that are serving. I think that they're all very excited about the opportunity to have resupply convoys driven autonomously so that they don't have to run the risk of, you know, getting blown up by an IED or something like that. So I think that there, it's too easy. And I think maybe a precondition of humankind to look at things with a negative outlook. But I think there's tremendous reasons to be optimistic. And I'm one of those guys that's optimistic about the next 10 years.
Yeah, no, that's well said. And it's going to be exciting to see how it all unfolds. Another thing we like to do here is kind of break down the barriers or silos that there may be for venture capital. And so with that, I mean, you have such a breadth of incredible experience, but what's some advice you would offer to any of our pilgrims looking to get into the world of venture capital?
I've got some advice that I wish I would have known about or given my former self, and it's a couple fold. I think the first piece of advice for the tech ecosystem broadly, which includes venture capital as well, is that don't worry so much about the role you're getting or the time you're getting it. Just work with people that are more impressive than you, more talented, more connected, more successful. And if I look back in my life in retrospect, that's what I've done again by accident. I had the opportunity to swim with the greatest Olympic swimmers of all time, whether it be Lochte, Phelps, so on and so forth. And guess what? Some of that rubs off and you can do great things with that. I had the opportunity to serve alongside very decorated war heroes who have silver stars, bronze stars, you know, Navy crosses, so on and so forth. And great things come from that. I have that true honor and privilege. And now here in Silicon Valley, if you just insert yourself with the top people in this industry, great things are going to come from it. And if I had to give myself a piece of advice back when I was going through grad school and trying to understand where I fit in this industry, it'd be don't sweat it as much. Just surround yourself with the most smart, talented people you possibly can, and opportunities are going to present themselves definitively. So that's the first piece of advice I would give. The second piece of advice, I think, is a little bit more nuanced. Generally speaking, I think people, when they engage with others, whether it be venture capital firms, when they engage with startups on the other side of the table or vice versa, are always asking for something and not really offering anything. I think it's important to reframe that dynamic. And more specifically to the venture community, one thing that I recommend anybody trying to break into venture is actually do your homework, do your research, identify an investment theme or an investment area that you have unique expertise in. For me as a veteran, talking about how companies could intersect with the government is, I think, a safe way to think about it. And so I'd recommend other veterans do something similar. But if you're a banker, you're on Wall Street, maybe fintech's the thing, or if you have a healthcare background, or you're a nurse, or you're a doctor, maybe that's your thing. Whatever it is, I don't presuppose to know for the listeners. But really think about that thesis and the things that excite you, and do a bunch of research. Talk to customers, talk to employees, talk to other investors. And once you have that done, you can then reach out to venture capital firms that maybe specialize in that investment area, or partners at multi-stage firms that invest in that area, and say, here's the work I've done. Here's how I think I could be helpful to you. Here's what I think is an interesting investment opportunity. Here's what I think isn't. Here's my mountain of research. Here's the customers I've talked to. Here's the employees I've talked to. Here's the partners I've talked to. And this is a real pain point. If you go in like offering something and showing somebody how you think and the work you've done in a way that could benefit the other side of the table, you will be shocked with the receptivity that you get. And guess what? Even if it doesn't work on that first time, you can learn something from that meeting and go back and brush off your diligence, reform your thesis, and go to the next person, and the next firm, and the next firm, and the next firm. And my bet is that if you get 10 firms deep, constantly refining that while being intelligent about who you're talking to and making sure that it's an area that aligns with that investor or that firm in question, you're going to get a job if you did your work. That's my philosophy on this. I recommended it. I, you know, wish I would have had this advice previously. Who knows if I would have followed it. I'm pretty bad at following my own advice. But the nasty secret about venture capital is nobody's ever hiring, but they're always hiring. I forget who told me that back in grad school, but it's one of these industries where rarely are you going to see a job on a job board. But for the right fit, people are very opportunistic, just like they are about investing in companies.
That's great advice. And I think just one quick point. I don't know if we've asked anybody this on the podcast, but for folks considering grad school specifically to get into venture, what did you get out of Stanford most, or just grad school in general, that you loved, or would you go back and do the same thing again?
I would. And I think there's different reasons why. Stanford is very unique because it's at the nexus of the venture capital and tech ecosystem, definitively. Like, it is most at the nexus. And then you have Berkeley and others that are around there as well. But Stanford's very much in the crosshairs. And so I think if you're interested in getting into venture and technology broadly, you'd be hard pressed to find a better place than Stanford to do so. So I think that was a positive byproduct of going there. But zooming out broadly in terms of grad school, I think it's most advantageous from a career change standpoint. Me getting out of the military and trying to find blaze a new path and a new career for me, I think it was extremely important, because otherwise I basically would have the financial pressure and the time pressure of choosing that first job, basically, where I got a job offer and then I'd be on the conveyor belt of doing whatever that is for a long period of time until I decided to change again. It's much harder, I would say, to take that 30,000 foot view of things, assess my relative strengths and weaknesses and desires and interests, and make a conscious decision to try and enter that industry. And so for me, maybe by chance, maybe by coincidence, or maybe by intention, me being at Stanford, surrounded by the technology ecosystem, by these hungry entrepreneurs and the financiers that back them, while also having the time of a couple years to just consider various career options and decide which one was the most interesting to me, gave me that breathing room and thinking room in order to enter that market. So long story short, if people are desiring a career change and you have the opportunity to go back to grad school, I think that gives you a lot of reflection time and analysis time to meet classmates of a whole bunch of different backgrounds, a whole bunch of different industries, to figure out what makes you tick. Maybe it's on the tech side, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's on the investing side. Maybe it's in something completely different that we're not even talking about in this podcast. I think that's okay. But I think that period of time gives you some of that reflection time that you, generally speaking, wouldn't get if you were, you know, working your day job, grinding it out day in and day out.
Yeah, thank you for that. That is awesome perspective and great advice in your previous answer as well. This has been awesome, Larson. Before we let you go, wanted to give you the opportunity to plug yourself, essentially. What's the best way for our listeners to follow what's going on at Harpoon and just connect with you?
Yeah, we have a website, harpoon.vc. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm becoming more active there, whereas previously I really didn't have much of a presence at all. And so I would say hit me up in a direct message or a LinkedIn in message on LinkedIn, and that's the best way to do it.
All right, Larson, just an awesome interview. Thanks for sharing your time with us, and we're excited to help share your story, what you're working on with Harpoon, and we'll catch you in Austin here in a couple of weeks for South by Southwest. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it, guys. Thanks so much for having me. Proud of all the work that you're doing, and anything I can ever do, let me know.
Thank you. See you soon.
Much appreciated. Yeah.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. Join us next week for another dose of Startups and Venture Capital. And as always, we appreciate our pilgrims spreading the word about the show. Share with your friends and help someone else make the pilgrimage. See you next time.
She told me that she only bumps my music when she's lonely. Thinks my vibe's a little low-key, okie dokie, that's alright, but wait, I don't know how to do that.